A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
Hey everyone, it's Alina.
And it's Susie. Today's episode is a conversation with our second time guest, Tony Ryan, co-founder of the National Network on Cuba and longtime CPUSA member and activist. We also have Ariane Aquino, a revolutionary activist studying medicine in Cuba.
We discuss the ways in which Cuba is a global leader of medicine and a pioneer of providing low-income, Black, Indigenous, people of color, and LGBTQ plus students from all over the world opportunities to study medicine with principles in providing affordable care for all and global peace and solidarity.
We hope that you learn as much from this episode as we did and enjoy.
Well, I just want to say this. I'm really very pleased to be collaborating with you all. And I'm also super pleased to be interacting with a medical student, and that I have met some of them and I've heard them speak, but I haven't directly, you know, interacted with them like at this level. And so I'm really excited about what Ariane is doing. I mean, she's literally one of the thousands that Cuba has trained, people from all over the world. I mean, the ELM, the Latin American School of Medicine, is quite a entity.
Mm. Ariane is here.
Hi. Yeah, sorry, I was having connection.
Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah,
we're super excited. I would love to start off with introductions. So give us like a background of who you are and the kind of work you're doing with Cuba.
Okay, first off, I really want to thank the Spectre Collective for having my participation. I've done one interview before that was with Dante, and I've listened to most of the interviews, and I think they're really good and really important that have been done on other issues. I'm a longtime activist. I'm 72 years old. I've been around the block several times. I've done a lot of work, community work, but very much particularly a lot of Latin American solidarity work with Nicaragua, with Mexico, with Cuba, and also been involved in a lot of activities in the United States, including in my early years, defense of the Black Panther Party, especially in the Bay Area where I was living at the time. I'm back in the Bay Area now and I'm in San Francisco. But I've been also an activist on various fronts for a long time. I'm a member of the Communist Party, and I'm proud to say that. And I am in the club in San Francisco, which is starting to grow, really good people that are in it. I was nominated, and I went to the convention last year in Chicago, where I participated. And so, yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks again, the Spectre, for having me, Susie, for inviting me, for remembering that I exist.
Oh my gosh.
I feel just so disconnected, being so far away from everyone and the work and the comrades here in Cuba. But my name is Arian. I'm 26 years old. I was born in the Philippines, then I had lived in Los Angeles up until I was 19, and then I'd moved to Olympia, Washington, where I got my radical education from the Evergreen State College, also where I met Susie. Mostly my interests lie in a lot of cooperative work, anarchy, autonomous stuff, autonomous like philosophy, environmental justice, cultural work, creative cultural work, none of which necessarily, you know, like directly relates to medicine. But for me, at least, I think they all relate to medicine, because at the end of the day, the reason why I, you know, organize and mobilize myself and my family and my community is because I think everyone deserves free healthcare. And, you know, healthcare is at least one of the only avenues of my activism that I felt like I had a clear path towards. And it was in a ways that I felt like I could really serve the people in a way that I felt like sort of like organizing that I was doing in the States couldn't quite get me to just yet. And people think medicine is just boring pharmaceuticals, but there's actually a lot of really, really cool work that can be done in healthcare and medicine that's more of like the radical type of organizing. But it's okay, we'll get to that conversation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear about that. That I'm interested in hearing about that side, because as far as I know, it's you have no leeway and it's just boring. It's just boring stuff. So I'm excited to hear your take.
Yeah, me too. But okay, thank you both for joining us today. We're so excited. We've been looking forward to this for weeks.
Indeed.
Yes. Unlike the episode that you recorded with Dante, where you covered everything relating to Cuba, including healthcare and the medical infrastructure, We're going to focus on Cuba's response to COVID-19, which is just this pandemic that's hit us like a brick. And, you know, as we've seen from watching our global leaders respond to this pandemic, an integral element of any pandemic response is global solidarity and collaboration. And all countries around the globe have really been put to the test, as we can see. Tony, I'm going to direct this question towards you, but Ariane, feel free to chime in whenever you want and add on. But I'm wondering if you can talk about the principal foundations of Cuba's medical internationalism, as well as the Henry Reeve International Medical Brigade, what it is and the history of it, how it plays into Cuba's medical internationalism, and just give us kind of like the basics before we go into the specifics on Cuba's response to COVID.
Okay, Cuba pretty much from day one did a number of things to start to move the revolutionary process forward. And one of the things that started was the literacy campaign, as well as the agrarian reform and the urban reform and a series of other things that happened. But very early on, they started to build a medical infrastructure. And with the view not only of covering full health care for the people of Cuba, but also being able to sustain and develop medical personnel and support basically medicine, preventative medicine fundamentally, but not only that, early on. And that in 1995, Fidel Castro at a conference of doctors specifically about disasters and pandemics, epidemics, proposed and was supported to name this group the Henry Reeve Brigade. So the origins of the Henry Reeve Brigade start in 1995, but the medical outlook of the Cuban revolutionary process was early on. Like, for example, between 1960 and 2018, Cuba had all kinds of personnel. And I'm not only talking about doctors, I'm talking about nurses, I'm talking about tech people, I'm talking about backup forces. And they've had that number, and the number was 325,000 personnel. And this is between 1960 and 2018. And they were in some 158 countries, all told, basically saving lives, participating in 1.6 million births, 9.1 million surgeries, 12.8 million vaccinations, and trained some 50,000 students in Cuba from all over the world. So we start and we understand, okay, that's the origins of the Henry Reeve Brigade. There are many things that happened before that. In 1963, there was an earthquake in Chile. Cuba was there. In 1998, Cuba was there for Hurricane Mitch in Nicaragua and Honduras, on the ground in both cases. So the point is here that this is a long process that's occurred. And that starting, I would believe, starting from the literacy campaign, which educated the Cuban people and gave them literacy, set the stage for the development of a lot of things in Cuba, including developing a medical technical base. Cuba, by the time COVID happened, was ready. Another thing that's really important is that not all the time, but often after these situations, many of the Cuban doctors and other personnel became involved with family medicine in these different countries. Oftentimes people will ask, well, who's this guy, Henry Reeve? Well, Henry Reeve was a North American guy who served in the Civil War on the Union side, and he was born in Brooklyn, 1850, and he died as a brigadier general in the Cuban Revolutionary Army in the war against Spanish colonialism in the 1870s. And he died in 1876. And he's regarded as an internationalist hero by the Cuban people, which is precisely why Fidel Castro in 1995 called for the creation, not the creation, but the naming of these medical brigades, the Henry Reeve Brigade. So that's really brief. And I'll be in this discussion, I'll be talking about a lot of different things, which are from this very, very important website, which I really urge comrades and friends to check out, which is cubanobel.org.
How has the Henry Reeve Brigade responded to the COVID pandemic?
So Cuba has sent about 20 plus brigades of various sizes, depending on the country and the scale of need. For example, in Italy, they sent more than 30, but in smaller nations like Grenada and Suriname, they maybe sent like 6 to 8 doctors. Well, not doctors, sorry, medical professionals, which is a mix of doctors, nurses, technicians, epidemiologists, and other sort of like pandemic related professions. They've responded pretty well. Actually, the first batch of Henry Brigade medical professionals that had left for Italy about 2 months ago, actually just came back earlier this week, and they've reported high success rates in being able to help the Italians sort of take a hold on Corona. And they do, there's nightly transmissions on TV where that's like actually a thing that I really appreciate about the Cuban like health sort of system here, is that they're really transparent about a lot of the processes that they do with the Cuban people. So they had this thing at 8 or so or 7 p.m. that's called Meso Redondo. And it's like roundtable discussion between MINSAP, which is the Ministry of Public Health in Cuba. And they give on the ground breaking information about how the government, where they feel like they stand in terms of tackling stuff, like where they stand internationally. So it's really accessible information.
That's awesome.
I think what's important to add is that Cuba's in, actually the latest information that I have, Cuba's in 27 different countries around the COVID pandemic.
How do they decide where, who goes where?
I think the process is the country in question talks to Cuba, and Cuba says, yes, we have this possibility of aiding you. But the thing is that probably, I don't know, they've got about 7,400 people in the field right now across the board. And this, again, let me stress that this is the Henry Reed Brigade starting from 1990, excuse me, it was founded in 1995, or rebranded, so to speak, I guess might be a term. But that before that, they've saved a lot of people's lives. They've done all this work on a lot of levels. And so there's this, and that predating the actual foundation or renaming of the Henry Reed Brigade, they were in West Africa. And this is very important because they were, guess what they were doing? They were dealing with Ebola in several different West African countries. And that a number of people, including medical people in the United States, saw what Cuba was doing and that supported it and greeted it. And that even, you know, the White House at a certain point, the Obama administration, had to admit that this was a very successful operation. Much later, of course. And then in 1995, the Henry Reed Brigade was actually, you know, rebranded, so to speak. But again, this is a process that's gone back to the early days of the revolution. I think it's really important to understand the importance of the creation of the infrastructure for Cuba to carry this out. It isn't just something that just happened. It was in the idea of the leadership or something like that, and then we'll do it. No, they created the basis to do it, the masses of Cuban people.
And what type of impact does the brigade have on Cuba's doctors that need to stay and provide care for Cuban residents? Well, I'm just wondering, like, if that places some type of strain on Cuban residents or Cuban medical healthcare and infrastructure.
Yeah. So I will add, actually, before answering this one, I will add that the way that they have, like, sort of select these countries to send these doctors to is sort of by two criteria. It's need, so like if there's like an extreme disaster, like a tsunami, or like we saw in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, well, they'll just straight up offer, you know, like they watch the news, so they'll just straight up offer. The second is based on sort of exchange, meaning that the country will either give a monetary compensation or an economic compensation. So for example, I know that Cuba had sent a ton of doctors to Venezuela to help them sort of redo their like super neoliberal, highly privatized healthcare system to try and maybe reflect more on like how the Cuban system currently is, which is like free, it's more preventative, it's highly accessible. And in exchange, Venezuela sent oil. But unfortunately, through the embargo, a lot of that oil was either seized by the US, and all of it gets to Cuba, basically. But to answer the question, there's actually a lot of Cuban doctors. It's like 1,000 patients to one doctor, which is, or I think the ratio is something comparable. I'm so sorry about my terrible, I just can't remember numbers for the life of me. But the ratio is very much reflective of like a first world nation's healthcare system. So there's if not better, actually. So there's just a huge multitude of doctors available for patients in Cuba. And so it's also like seen as like such a very honorable thing to be part of a brigade. And so people will definitely, there's like, if there's willing participants and there's a ton of doctors, like there's, I wouldn't say necessarily an endless supply of like willing doctors, but there's like a steady flow, you know? So it's not really, and people think that it's like an idea of a stream, but that's because in the US we might just be accustomed to the fact that healthcare professionals are scarce for us, you know, like we have to wait long lines and our provider has like about 700 like plus patients in like an amount of like 4 days, you know, they're very hard to reach unless you get really lucky and have like that new messaging service that a lot of these like on-point care providers have. So in general, it's not like an actual strain on the economy. And if anything, it's actually one of their, main sort of like income drives into the Cuban economy, the second being tourism, which I found out very recently. I wish there was a more clear top three list, but working on finding that information still. So hopefully that makes sense, which I think does, because there's just a ton of Cuban doctors just everywhere. And so if you have this like steady flow of like actually building a healthcare system in another country and they have to be there for a long time, the country is likely, you know, giving Cuba also a steady compensation for them helping their healthcare industry.
I mean, I think what's important here is that this is a voluntary procedure. There's been, you know, scandalous lying information coming out of Washington, the Trump administration, that somehow these doctors and medical personnel in general are enslaved by the Cuban government, and that, you know, that could not be farther from the truth. The truth is that Cuba has, as just Ariane just pointed out, there's a lot of doctors. They've graduated a lot of doctors. They've graduated nurses. They've graduated technical personnel. And it's open. So a lot of people that are doing this, okay, they have families. They come from these different communities in Cuba. But this is a voluntary process. And it's a selection process on the part of the Ministry of Health. And also, if you became a member of the Henry Reeve Brigade, you know, and you have a family and you're married or you have dependents like your mother or your grandfather or whatever, those people are taken care of in Cuba while you're gone. And so, yeah, they don't make a lot of money, quote unquote, but their families and their situation in Cuba is looked after by the process. And that also, yeah, Cuba, you know, Cuba takes some money from richer nations as opposed to poorer nations. There's no, like, if you're in some really, really poor country, Cuba's not going to charge anything. But if you're in a country like Italy, Italy pays.
Yeah. I mean, also services cost money. Like, they have to get their medical supplies from somewhere and pay for the labor somehow. So, Ariane, can you talk a little bit about your experience as both a medical student and also a resident of Cuba during the pandemic?
So everything just happened literally so fast, and I just feel really fortunate to be in a country where this like crazy, like terrible disease has really, really been kept pretty well, I would say. You know, there's a lot of like non-believers right now just because they don't personally see someone with corona. But luckily in the school, no one so far has it, and we have very low exposure rates to possible people who could have it, which at the beginning stages of the sort of like implementation of their three-step pandemic program, which was closing borders, closing commercial centers, closing recreational centers, closing basically any like large-scale social access point. It's been quiet. It's been a little rough. You know, we've been in school lockdown. I haven't been able to leave school campus for like almost 2 months now. You know, the personal part is a little frustrating, as everyone can probably relate to the quarantine aspects of life that we're all sort of like going through right now. But in general, they responded really well. They responded really fast. Again, like I mentioned earlier before, with their transparency, they made sure that they, because even before they actually implemented their pandemic program, they had been talking about how they were processing a lot of the international news since it came out of China. So in the TV broadcast, they were saying they were trying to produce as much, reproduce as much information as they could. Like, hey, it seems like China is saying that these are the symptoms. You know, like they tried really hard to have their citizens have groundbreaking. I don't know the word right now. Groundbreaking information as it was published by these different nations who were seeing the slower progression on the international scale of coronavirus. Eventually it just got really hard because things are already really inaccessible in Cuba. Like we already have lines for chicken. We already have lines for like soap and toothpaste and shampoo. So for those who don't live within the school that luckily has some access points, like some commercial access points for like snacks and body wash and stuff like that, it's been a little challenging for regular residents. And the social distancing is also really hard because the buses are always super crammed. And so how are you supposed to practice social distancing on a bus? And so they eventually had to cancel the bus route. So that really, you know, damaged a lot of people's ways to get to work or to see their families. But they did give a lot of like free masks. Like everyone got a free mask. And if you didn't get a free mask, you could request one from the local clinic. It was the military and medical personnel on the ground that had distributed them to families. And then as far as like when there was actual cases, all of them were isolated really, really quickly in the institutional for like pandemic / like tropical medicine, which was really good because they had already been planning. So as they were like watching these different countries experience it, they were sort of already trying to figure out like how are they going to rework their infrastructure and like whatever little sort of like resources that they had to try and really tackle this. And they also, this is like a really great thing, but even so, while they were like watching and planning all this, they bought so much testing kits. Like they were doing like 1,000 or like 1,200 tests like every single day in different regions of the country, which is like already a ton of people, you know? And so that's like how you tackle a pandemic to help decrease it from spread, because the only way you can actually figure out where it's going is the regions that you're testing. So they did mass testing, and if they didn't have testing kits, they did this thing called pesquisa, which is community surveying, which third to sixth year medical students are asked, it's like totally volunteer, are asked to participate in, which is just going to different residential homes and asking like, hey, how are you feeling? Like, what do you know about corona? Like, can we help you? Like, can we educate you a little bit? Do you feel like you have symptoms? Like, have you had a fever? You know, just like sort of doing like a little check-in with them. Just because it then helps, because if you already have a scarcity of testing kits, then like you obviously want to use them and with populations and families that have a higher chance of actually being exposed to corona. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that was a really, really smart move for them. It also definitely helped as far as like quote unquote labor costs, which is what we always think about in the U.S. How are we going to pay these volunteers? It's like, well, it's volunteers, you know, they want to do it for the good of the Cuban people. And so like my friend who's in third year right now, she has been doing pesquisa since they offered it, which was probably a week or two after the Ministry of Health formally put institutions like ours on lockdown and closed public schools, libraries, and museums and stuff like that.
Wow, thanks. Yeah, that's really exciting. I love the fact that they're just going door to door like that.
I feel like sometimes I like don't really think about it as much because I just like live here now and it's so normal for me to hear that. But then if I think about it like as an American, I'm like, wait, like what?
Yeah, you know, because there's so much misinformation that, you know, so many Americans are getting. So to have actual medical professionals come and break down some of those misnomers and things like that would help so much, you know, and probably would stop the spread a lot because people would get valid information a lot, hopefully quicker.
Yeah. And it also helps like make the population actually feel like they're part of their own healthcare process, because I think that's 100%. What we lack in the U.S., especially with like historical trauma, you know, of like non-white bodies. And then, you know what I mean? So it's just it's just so much more cultural. It's just so much more humane to have actual to spend time to talk to someone and be like, hey, you know, like, I don't need to give you like a super fancy like medical. I just like want to know where you're at with this stuff. How are you feeling? Mm-hmm. And therefore, at least to some degree, the Cuban people feel not only proud of their healthcare system, but also feel involved and like mm-hmm. practice their sense of autonomy.
Yeah, you know, you feel like you can trust them.
That's good. That's what you want. Yeah, and that's what you want when you want a culture that and a country and a population to actually improve their health statistics is for them to actually care about it. And for them to care about it, they have to feel like it's a cultural value.
100%. Yeah, yeah. Hey, Tony, would you be able to let us know, like, has the U.S. embargo impacted Cuba's ability to respond to COVID in the most efficient way, or is that kind of, I'm not sure how extreme the embargo is these days.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has. And I call it the blockade. And because the blockade was initiated in the early 60s, and it has damaged the Cuban economy in terms of billions of dollars. And then year after year, the UN General Assembly has voted overwhelmingly in favor of lifting the blockade on the part of the U.S. government. But I think what's important here is that the blockade is structured in such a way that it affects other countries. So that if you're France and your company, there's a company, I'll just give you a kind of an example. If you're a French company and you're doing business with Cuba and you're selling Cuba a machine, not only medical stuff, but other stuff, and there's any part in that machine that's made or controlled by a U.S. company, literally that bank or that company in France could be fined. And this keeps happening. And that it happened even after the opening between the Cuban government and the U.S. government, where Raul Castro went on Cuban TV simultaneously with Barack Obama going
right,
on.
Right.
And that that continued, and that it has only been strengthened and deepened and developed with the arrival of the Trump administration. And yeah, it's definitely affected the ability of Cuba to, because Cuba can't produce everything that it needs. Luckily, they have a relationship with a number of other countries that are able to defy the U.S. blockade. And like China, you know, or Russia, or which is also, I mean, China and Russia are both sanctioned by the United States on a number of points. And there's a lot of countries that are sanctioned at the moment by the United States. It's not only Cuba. So yeah, it's definitely serious. And that's one of the things I think is really important for comrades and friends is to get involved here, trying to end the blockade and raise the question, because here it's a humanitarian mission. And that once people understand that it's not some way Cuba making money off of these different countries or some kind of, you know, lying crap from the Trump administration. But yes, it's a very important thing that has happened. Other countries should be doing this. And frently, I mean, recently Noam Chomsky and other people have said that in fact Cuba is leading the struggle against the pandemic. So here's the United States with the highest level of infections, and then second and only by Brazil, which is the worst after the United States. And Brazil threw out with the arrival of Bolsonaro, the fascist who's in power now, they threw the Cuban doctor and medical personnel out of Brazil. So this kind of behavior internationally is something I think a lot of people all over the world are absolutely just totally disturbed by and angered by, and that we should, as U.S. citizens and people living in this country, whether they're citizens or not, we should be actively involved against the blockade at all levels, not only medical, but you know, Cuba has had, you know, it loses billions of dollars over the years. I would also just like to say here, I've had personal experience with Cuban doctors a number of times, but when I went to Cuba in February, I flew from Miami, and you know, as is normal, a number of things are passed out to the passengers, including make sure that you fill out the visa card and also get yourself, what kind of stuff are you bringing into Cuba? You have to clear Cuban customs. All this stuff. So But also in this little packet that was passed out was a questionnaire from the Cuban Ministry of Health. And I'm looking at it and I'm reading it and I say, damn, these are symptoms of COVID. And this is early on in February of this year. And, you know, so when we landed in Havana, I cleared customs, you know, I went through the whole process. And then I was told to go over and talk to this table that was nearby, which was from the Ministry of Health. And I walked over and there's a Cuban doctor there and he starts talking to me. And he said, what kind of symptoms do you have? Because I had checked that I was coughing. And they'd also asked other questions and I was fine with the others. And he said, well, what have you done about it? I said, well, I went to my doctor and he didn't seem to think anything was going on except that because I smoke, that's probably what the reason was. So he had a big smile on his face and he looked at me and he said, look, you know what this is about. You read about this in the United States. We are aware of this. And, you know, we suggested if there's anything that happens to you while you're here in Cuba, which was a three week period, you know, to contact medical personnel. And then he, as I was leaving, he goes, oh, and by the way, maybe you should think about quitting smoking. So that's my story.
That was the afterthought, huh? I mean, now that you're talking about your time in Cuba, Tony, you also mentioned like where you were staying and how they reacted to COVID. So if you could share that with us, I thought that was a great story. And yeah, let's hear about that.
Well, I had the very good fortune, more ways than one, I stayed in a house that I'd been to Cuba before many times, and several times I've stayed in people's homes. I really like that. I'm not one of these people that requires and doesn't want, I don't want to stay in a hotel. I don't want to stay, any of that doesn't, it doesn't, because I feel like by living in people's homes, I get to learn some things about what they're doing, how they feel about things. Mm-hmm. So this time around, I stayed in the home of this woman who was a friend of mine. And he had suggested that I contact her. So I did. And she had this beautiful house in this area of Havana called the Vedado. And it was a little bit out of the way. Historically, I really have preferred to stay in Old Havana, which is easier because I was there for the book fair. And I try to go to Cuba every year for the International Book Fair. But anyway,
I love that. Excellent book fair, by the way.
Oh, it's fun. It's really great. Anyway, so I came in and I wasn't feeling that great. Turns out that this woman whose house it was, her daughter and her daughter's companion were both nurses at this hospital, which was two or three blocks away from the house. And her daughter and her companion, this young man, maybe a couple of years older than her daughter's like 19 years old, and they're trained nurses. And so I was basically checked out by both this daughter and her companion. They were both checking me out and talking to me and just asking me, much like the thing that Ariana talked about, where you go and talk to people in the community. I was treated the same way. They asked me, well, how do you feel? What's going on? Blah, blah, you know, all these different things. And so I was very fortunate to actually be in a house with two medical people. And then not only that, I had an incident that happened to me. I noticed that happened to me when I was at the book fair. I had a swelling in one of my wrists. And it didn't hurt, but it was just this big swelling. And I didn't think much about it, but I did say something when I got back to the house. And the woman of the house said, oh, we're going to go to the doctor tomorrow. And I said, okay, well, okay. And she goes, no, don't worry. We're not going to go to a clinic. We're going to go to a friend of mine who's a couple of blocks away, and she'll take a look at you. She's a doctor. So about 10 o'clock in the morning, we went over, and she looked at me, and she said, I thought I had strained a muscle because I was carrying these books around and, you know, at the fair, and I thought I maybe had twisted or something. And she said, no, it looks like an insect bite. And she pulled out of her pocket, Benadryl tablets. And she suggested that I take them. And then it cleared up in a couple of days. So, yeah, that's the kind of experience. I mean, this last trip, I had I guess, three interactions with Cuban medical people. I've had experiences before on other trips, going back to the first time I went, way back in 1969.
Thanks, Tony. Something that I was reading that a lot of Americans, in their attempts to discredit the Cuban healthcare system, they'll say that the quality of care depends on your class status, and like a lot of tourists in America get better care. I wonder if you can kind of respond to that sentiment and in an open and honest way, like, does class status really determine the quality of care in Cuba?
I would say to a degree, because, okay, so there is this myth that Cuba is still 100% communism, which is not true. It's more of socialism, capitalism right now. And to say that, you know, yes, I agree that the revolution is still, you know, thriving and alive, and there's still a lot of really good efforts being made to sort of keep Fidel's vision for the country alive. But there, you can't deny the presence of capitalism is still really strong. You know, like, there are still really rich Cubans who get like really strong remittances from family members in Miami. And there's unfortunately a lot of Republican Miami Cubans, but I wouldn't necessarily say that they get the best care. But like, for example, if your family, if you're like a sort of like upper middle class, like Cuban family, for whatever reason, whether that's remittances or you have a business, but by the way, the government like tries to regulate how much earnings a business gets, a percentage of your income, like your, yeah, it's you have to give it to the government, which makes sense because they need it for, to keep up with their, you know, for education, for healthcare.
Right.
So it would make sense that if you, quote unquote, like have a hookup like that, like you could just pay out of pocket to get that better care. But I will also say that because, you know, Cuba takes a lot of pride in their healthcare system's imagery, that there is a little bit of a bias where they do give Americans an experience that is close to what Americans are likely going to experience, which is like bigger hospitals and all this stuff, because Americans just, we're just not used to how Cuba does healthcare, which is very much community-based and preventative. Like, there's no way that I could imagine an American really enjoying going to a polyclinic. They'd probably think the polyclinic is just like some small, like, poor institution, and they couldn't help with their chronic disease. But really, the polyclinics are the first door, the first gate, you know, for you to actually access this like bigger industry of like specialized care that is very intent on using resources, whatever it has, in the points where it's actually needed, rather than how the US is just like, oh, you need a CT scan for this weird finger injury, let's do it.
Right, you don't need a CT scan.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so they're strategic, and unfortunately, even with their strategic healthcare system, there people will find ways to access more luxurious care and stuff like that. So I don't necessarily doubt that Americans feel like there's, and foreigners feel like there's some bias, because I did have a friend, a group of friends who had visited, and who was queer and trans, and they were telling me that they had such a great experience and that they had to pay so little and that it was still a really amazing experience, and it was in the hospital and all this stuff. And, you know, and it's just like, I trust them. They're really good. They do a lot of organizing too. You know, they brought this huge luggage of just toys for children that they were just handing out, you know, but I don't doubt that to some degree, like, the medical professionals knew what they were doing, because they knew that if a bad story let out, it would hurt the image, you know. So it's like, it's strategic and also the public relations sense, not just in the like institutional healthcare for its people like sense.
I think what's really important is that if you go to Cuba as a foreigner, whether you're from the States or not, you're treated to, you're there. I don't know the details right now, but in years past, you know, there was a table that you went to when you arrived, and you paid out like about $2 a day, $2 for every day that you were there, and you got full care. And years before, it was completely free, but because of the falling apart of the socialist camp and a lot of other issues, they started to charge, but it's nominal. I'll give you an example, and I talk about this in the first interview that was done with me by Spectre, the Spectre Collective. I had a friend, she's gone away now. She was an activist in the Bay Area, and she was with elderly when she was there. She was in her 70s, probably maybe late 70s. And she was with this friend of hers, this other woman, and they were walking down the street, and these kids knocked them down and stole their purses. And this was in Havana many years, about 30 years ago. And the cops caught the kids, but one of them, my friend, Peely, she broke her leg in the process. And she was due to go back to the Bay Area a couple of days later, and they took her to a hospital, and she said, listen, I have to get back to the Bay Area. And the Cubans that were treating her and looking at her, they said, look, you have a bad break in your leg. You can leave if you want, but we would strongly suggest that you stay, and that don't worry about what it's going to cost you. It'll be covered by the Ministry of Health, by Cuba, by the revolutionary process. She was not a citizen of Cuba. She was not, she was a member of the Communist Party at the time, but that didn't figure in the equation. And that she ended up being, she spent another couple of months in Cuba. And so I think I look at the way, from my experience dealing with medical people in Cuba several times, including nurses and technical people, I think they really, they're very careful about that. Now, the other thing I want to mention before I forget, and that is there's a recent film that was on PBS, I believe. It was about this guy, and apparently this is a lot of people that do it. There's a drug, I can't remember the name of it, a pharmaceutical, and it's not available in the United States because of the blockade, but it's been tested in a number of countries, and it has to do with lung cancers and other things. And this guy had lung cancer, and he goes periodically, even though he's not supposed to. He's violating. You can't go to Cuba for medical treatment. But he goes and he gets this drug. And I don't remember the name of it, but it's an actually really interesting program that came out maybe 2 months ago. Also, just want to add this. When I went to see this doctor who looked at the bump on my wrist, I kind of, like I said, okay, well, thank you very much. While I'm sitting here, I would like to ask you if I could possibly get this cough spray, a bronchial spray, which had been prescribed to me by my doctor here in the States. I ran out of it. My then doctor retired, so I didn't have this spray, which really helped me in some cases to clear my throat and my lungs. And she looked at me and she said, I would like to be able to give you this, but I can't. It's only, that kind of medicine is only available for people who are really chronic, and you're not chronic. And as far as she could tell, and she said, and I asked her, well, how come? And she said, because the blockade. So I experienced the effect of the blockade in a minor way that Cubans on a daily basis experience.
Right. Thanks, Tony. Yeah, I do want to briefly respond to Arianne, what you mentioned about some people just really kind of wanting to bypass maybe the more accessible clinics and going towards some like lofty facility. I feel like that's just something that Americans and maybe, obviously that reach goes beyond America, but we're just socialized to think that care has to be expensive, otherwise you're not getting quality care. And that concept is just so foreign to us. So it'd be nice if we could, all kind of support those systems. And that's funny because if we all supported those systems at that most basic level and the most accessible level, then it will probably make those systems stronger.
You start to look at the healthcare system in Cuba, and then you look at the state of the healthcare in the United States and why it's so important that comrades and friends get involved in the struggle for healthcare in the United States, such as the bills that are in Congress right now that have been supported by people like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. A number of other progressive forces in the United States are talking about broadening out the healthcare situation in the United States and making it more accessible. I think in the process of the struggle for that in this country, we can learn a lot from what the Cubans have done.
I will say that the thing, the truly big secret demon of the medical industry in the U.S. is the pharmaceutical company. And the thing is, the way the Cubans were able to bypass that, even though that is one of the biggest sort of pains of the blockade, is that Cuba tries to prioritize making its own pharmaceuticals because they know that certain chemicals certain just like containers are just really expensive and inaccessible, especially if you depend on an like external market, you know. And so I think that's what I appreciate about like one of the strategies that Cuba has in keeping their stuff relatively low cost. And if they actually produce it successfully, they're able to sell it, like that respiratory drug that Tony had mentioned earlier, which I literally was just talking about like a few days ago, and now I cannot remember the name. It's like, it's not a very exciting name. It's like REN7 or something like that. And the thing is, I have hope that we will achieve some sense of like universal healthcare, because I know that at least the state that I was living in prior to coming to Cuba, Washington State, had already started petitions to have the state at least have some sort of like universalized healthcare. But it's the pharmaceutical is sort of like big business, you know. They really pressure doctors to sell their product. That's also how doctors get paid, as much as insurance is through pharmaceuticals. Like, hey, if you could sell this to your patients, you know, like if you can prescribe this, like we'll give you a cut and stuff like that. You know, like they have a hold on how patients actually advocate for themselves when they are receiving lawsuits from these patients about their own pharmaceuticals. They're like, that's not true, that's not what we said. You know, it's just this like huge game, and it's really frustrating, because even though we want to advocate for free access, there's always the secret like pharmaceutical companies that like intentionally want to pump these like chemical drugs, these all this just craziness into our body, so that we rely on pharmaceuticals more often, therefore relying on insurance more often, because who's going to pay for all these pills, you know what I'm saying? So it's just
a
like
nasty, really nasty cycle. Oh, I know. I try to tell, well, my entire family about that, honestly. I'm like, you know, advocate for yourself, and don't let anyone, doctor or otherwise, you know, tell you what you're feeling, what you need, what you want, and especially knowing what's behind all of these decisions. It just comes down to a dollar amount and a paycheck, right? But you pretty much, you kind of led me into what I wanted to talk to you about next. So, I mean, in the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned that you really have some revolutionary hopes for, I guess, Cuba's medical, well, maybe more of the U.S.'s medical system, but can you talk more about what you would like to see from both the U.S. and Cuba and how they handle these industries?
Dang, what a question. I will say that I definitely agree with Tony that, like, yes, like the Americans need to advocate for the blockade to be removed like immediately. It is causing a lot of human rights disruptions, as well as, I mean, when I was thinking about that parts, you know, example, like it's truly malicious to me, the amount of detail that the U.S. maliciously writes into their lawsuits so that countries cannot work outside of U.S. Realm, basically, you know, like the fact that this one tiny nail basically has U.S. written all over and they can't be used without like paying the U.S. to some degree is insanity. And so that involves like, so lifting the blockade in terms of like improving medical system would just be an influx of resources and money for the Cuban medical industry, as well as creative investigative side. Whatever aspect of life you can think of, the blockade literally touches, you know, so it inhibits like medical exchange of information, and inhibits research exchange information, and inhibits like professionals from Cuba to actually going to whatever part of the world or whatever part of the U.S. They're invited to for a conference, even, you know, like, and it's just like this terrible veil that just like needs to be lifted immediately. And so I've been trying to look for like revolutionary writing on like what a world without the blockade for the medical industry would look like, because it just is such a wild, not so much a wild fantasy, but it's just literally just like a floodgate of just great things that would happen if you just lift the blockade for the Cuban healthcare industry. But for the U.S., things are more successful at a local level. And we have seen that time and time again with smaller health projects and with the Cuban government. It's really tricky to try and continuously steadily allocate resources when communities are just inherently not the same. Not to like lead into health stereotypes, but certain communities, because of their diet, require certain health necessities. And so it just doesn't make sense for every single place to have like this huge CT scanner when maybe that's not actually, you know. And so it would just need a complete restructuring of how we actually see health, in terms of like, well, if I'm sick, the clinic that I should go to, every single aspect of my health should be, you know, considered, available to be examined, which is just like not necessarily realistic if we actually respect like the finiteness of resources, you know? So that is a recommendation I would think about, like, ideally, personally, I would tear it all down, but, you know, I would just like, decrease the size just a casual. Bit more.
Personal.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I would sort of decrease it to have it less, so people feel like they have to go to emergency rooms or big hospitals. Like, the idea would be that they would respond to be like, okay, like, I like how Cuba is, like, what's the nearest health facility that is a community-based that I can go to with chronic diseases? You know, rather than going to like this huge like hospital every single time for just like a tiny checkup when there's like already such a long line, you know. The second thing would be regulating the pharmaceutical industry because they just have too much of a financial and just literally ethical hold on the industry. Considering they just, not only do they have this like economic hold, but they also have this cultural hold. You know, they make us think that health is so easily fixable with just like pills and just takes time, you know, but really health isn't like that, you know. And I mean, personally, I would like to see more health collectives, meaning more health collectives, meaning that like the community members actually build like a health infrastructure that reflects them and their needs. Literally my dream, with a little garden too and everything.
Yes,
you know,
come back, Arian, come back, we need you.
Seriously,
I know, come you have to wait like 5 more years. I'm so sorry, I'm studying hard.
I'll get the garden
the
going.
Thing is, like, yeah, the thing is, this the Cuban education is an additional 3 years, so med school is like 4 years, here it's 7 years, you know. But I'm sorry, I swear to God, I'm coming. Just please be ready. You know, ideally, we would be also smarter about our resources. I mean, that's the thing. It's just like, is America the land of abundance because we just inherently just have a ton of money? Or is it because these are resources extracted in strategic economic ways?
Right.
And do we have to, you know, aggressively extract these resources in these ways? Do we have to have these laws? You know, it's just, it would just take a complete overhauling of how we prioritize health. If that makes sense.
There's a huge amount of people in the United States that are trained medically, not only doctors again, and many of them are quite progressive. And I've had the good fortune to pretty much be treated by the medical system when I needed. I got lucky with the doctors I got and the people that I've dealt with. And I think there's a lot of interest in the medical community about this. And I think what's important is to try to involve them, because they know what they're talking about and they could learn a lot from what the Cubans have done, and that the Cubans conversely could learn a lot from people here in the United States. And I would strongly suggest that comrades and friends get involved, whether it's the Venceremos Brigade, Pastors for Peace, the National Network on Cuba, or Code Pink, or whatever. All these organizations are deeply involved right now in this struggle around calling for Cuba in 2021, the Henry Reed Brigade, to get the Nobel Prize. And again, I mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. Check out this website called cubanobel.org. This is a very, very important website. It's got all kinds of stuff on it. A lot of what I said today, I got from this website. There's a lot of videos. There's all these webinars that have been done that are available. And get involved in your local community and try to get medical people involved and raise the issue. But whether Cuba actually gets the award in 2021 or not is immaterial. We need to do the work toward that happening and that getting in people involved on such an important issue as public health is super important. I would just say, look at what the facts are. And the fact is that Cuba is a medical power in the world. It's not a superpower. It's not a military. Well, it has done military actions, carrying out struggle in support of the people of Angola, for example. But it's a power medically and culturally, and that it's one of the leaders in the struggle against COVID. The fact that this blockade is stopping Cuba substantially from interacting with key medical people in the United States is a crime. What we need now is to call for that to stop. I would urge again to everyone who's listening that people should go to Cuba and see for themselves. Don't take anybody's word for it, starting with me. What I saw, what I know, I believe is true. But we have a real duty. It's called internationalism. We should be Henry Reeves, okay? Mm-hmm. All of us. So thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you, Tony. And thanks, you, Ariane.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick pitch about the scholarship. Cuba offers medical scholarships to low-income communities as well as different countries, but specifically the organization that Tony had mentioned called Pastors for Peace is the organization that hosts the medical scholarship for U.S. students to come study medicine in Cuba for free, 7 years full scholarship. That is the scholarship that I'm on. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm having a great time. It is a bit of an adjustment. And those little personal details, I'm happy to counsel someone with. If any of the listeners or, you know someone who's actually interested in medicine or just thinking about how to make the world a better place, even if, you know, you're not really sure. Because I necessarily didn't think that my activism was going to be through medicine, but everything kind of like fit like a puzzle piece and, you know. It called me, I guess you can say, but you know, it's a really supportive organization. It's a really, really unique and special opportunity considering that a medical school education in the Americas is about $500,000. So a lot of black and brown communities, you know, queer and trans communities may never ever see enough income to support this medical school education. And so I would just really highly encourage listeners and just everyone to just start thinking about, you know, the scholarship, whether even if it's not for you personally, but if you feel like you have someone who's like an activist or a medical student, either one, or not even any of those categories, who is interested, who you think would be a good fit, please consider the scholarship because it is a really unique and important opportunity. And it does, a lot of the graduates that we have do get matched to hospitals and residency programs. We are an accredited university. A lot of Americans like to think that we're not, and we definitely produce very unique doctors. Again, thank you so much to everyone for having me here.
Thank you, Ariane. This was great. This was really, I learned a lot from both of you, and I'm excited to share what I've learned too with everyone, because I have some nurse friends, and like I think a lot of people feel like they can't incorporate their activism in the medical fields.
I just want to say one more thing, and I'll be very brief. But next Tuesday, there's going to be a webinar, a dialogue between Ambassador Cabanas of Cuba to the United States and the actor Danny Glover. Danny Glover, yeah. And it's going to be on the website. One of the people that's sponsoring it is the people that are working on CubaNobel.org. So people can get that information at CubaNobel.org. But it's next 8 o'clock Eastern Time and 5 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. Again, thank you very much.
All right, cool. Thanks, y'all, and have a good night, everyone.